This Week in Cycling, a history of our wonderful sport for the discerning listener.
This July, we could be witness to the spectacle of a new rider entering one of the most exclusive clubs in cycling, the club containing five-time Tour de France winners. There used to be five members of the club, then one got booted out, so now there are only four again. But Chris Froome could bring it back to five in a few weeks' time. In so doing, he would also be joining an even more exclusive club of riders who have won four consecutive Grand Tours. No prizes for guessing the only other rider to have done that is Eddy Merckx. The other members of the five-time club are Miguel Indurain, Bernard Hinault, and the first, the original, the pioneer of the quintuple conquest, Jacques Anquetil. When Anquetil won his fifth Tour in 1964, he already held the record for most wins, as nobody before him had ever previously won four. Philippe Thys and Louis-Saint Bobet had both won three, and a hefty nine riders had twice been winners of the Tour. But Anquetil's domination of the race was something which had never before been witnessed. Froome would also be echoing Anquetil in that the Frenchman won his fifth Tour by completing a Giro Tour double, as did Merckx, as did Hinault. But Anquetil's fifth and final Tour win was undoubtedly his hardest fought. Given that his first win back in 1957 had been by a margin of almost 15 minutes, the ding-dong battle with Raymond Poulidor coming down to several seconds in 1964 was even more striking. It was also the first ever year that the Tour organisers decided to end the race with a time trial, a decision that they would certainly not regret. Richard Yates gives us the details of that final test against the clock in his book Master Jacques, The Enigma of Jacques Anquetil. If any Frenchman had made previous plans for that Sunday, they cancelled them. Those not privileged to be on the route were in front of a TV set, either at home or in a bar. The morning stage to Versailles was won by the Belgian world champion Benoni Bayhait. A short break for lunch and then down to the real business. What a Tour. Poupou at 14 seconds and Federico Bahamontes at 1 minute 33. There had never been a Tour as tight as this before. The Lantern Rouge was Anquetil's teammate, Anatole Novak, and as he launched himself into the final 27 kilometres to Paris, a huge roar went up. In just a couple of hours, the 1964 Tour de France would be won and lost. But by whom? Eventually, Poulidor started, to be followed a minute later by Anquetil. There were no shortage of time checks, and they showed that although Jacques was in the lead, Poupou was closing the gap, and closing it, and closing it. Just 5 kilometres to go, and Raymond was 3 seconds down. 3 seconds. If he beat Jacques by 1 second, he would get the time bonus and win the race. But Jacques was calm, so calm and well informed. It was now or never, just one final supreme effort, and he would go down in history as the first man to win 5 Tours de France. There was a huge roar of approval as Poulidor caught his minuteman Bahamontes on the Parc de Prince track. Just a few more seconds and Anquetil would arrive. When he did, it was jubilation for the Anquetilists and groans from the Poulidorists. The gap was 21 seconds and Jacques had won. When the two men rode a lap of honour together with their arms round each other's shoulders, there was nothing but heartfelt applause. If Raymond looked just a little rueful, Anquetil looked radiant, as well he might. He was later to say that this time trial was one of the best exploits of his career and one of his best memories. It was an emotional climax to a wonderful afternoon and a fabulous Tour. None of those present at the Parc de Prince would ever forget it. As the two Frenchmen climbed on the podium, Anquetil gave a little grin and murmured in Poulidor's ear, "You really made me sweat this time, Raymond." From Jacques, this was quite a compliment.
Welcome to This Week in Cycling History. It's been a wee while. How's the family?
Not too bad. Growing. Multiplying. Well.
It's funny actually because we were talking before we started recording, and once you get to two it's a much more relaxed affair than the panic of the first child. But it's good to have you back. People have been missing you, and it's just before the Tour de France, where a lot of the talk is of course about Chris Froome going for his potential fifth victory. Now, in my lifetime, 5 Tours de France was a really big thing. You know, Miguel Indurain achieving it was astonishing, absolutely brilliant. Before him, there'd been, you know, the immortal Bernard Hinault, Merckx, of course, Jacques Anquetil. But when Anquetil first won it, it wasn't really a thing, was it? It was just the first somebody'd won five.
Yeah, and I've certainly grown up with this magical number of 5 Tours de France as being the benchmark of greatness, and but of course it wasn't always a thing. It only be became a thing. It's very hard to know when these things become a thing. I remember speaking about this before, about the Triple Crown, and when Eddie Merckx won the Giro, the Tour, and the Worlds. And I did make a pretty big effort to dig through newspaper archives online, which can be time consuming and quite cumbersome to pick through. And as far as I could tell, certainly in the English speaking media, it only became a thing when Roach did it, and all of a sudden, oh, Roach has done something that Eddie Merckx only Eddie Merckx has done. That's impressive, and you know, let's latch onto that. And the media did, and then Roach did, and you know, they haven't let go since. And now this collection of three races has become a thing, even though only two people have ever done it. But I suppose because only two people have ever done it. But of course, the same is true of five Tours de France. Before Anquetil did it, nobody had done it. So, you know, the benchmark had been three, as I kind of said in the piece. That had been done by Philippe Thys and Louis-Saint Bobé relatively recently, before Anquetil. But yeah, five was just another big number. And I would assume it was only when Eddie Merckx managed it that all of a sudden it was, oh, Merckx has done something that only Anquetil has done. And then five became this benchmark. And strangely, it just kept on happening. Eno managed five and Indrain managed five. And I do remember when Armstrong, I neglected to mention Armstrong in the piece. Obviously, he won seven and subsequently is no longer is part of this club. But when he won his fifth in 2003, I remember being really satisfied that there was now five riders who had won the Tour de France five times. Of course, that didn't last, and Armstrong won his sixth, and now he's won none, or whatever way you want to look at it. And but it is one of those stats that stayed in my head and got me kind of fascinated in this statistical side of things. I remember saying before that the other one that kind of piqued my interest came after the 1994 Tour de France, when the only two British riders in the race when the Tour went to Britain ended up wearing the yellow jersey. Yeah, which was kind of unfortunate in that awful team time trial that they had that year with his GAN team. But these stats, I don't know. I have a brain that enjoys really, really nice stats like that. I remember another one. Maybe I'll just slip it in because the World Cup is happening at the moment. That I remember there was a World Cup stat before Brazil won the World Cup in 1994, which was when I kind of really, it was the first World Cup I really was old enough to appreciate and was watching properly. There was three teams that had won it three times, two teams that had won it twice, and one team that had won it once. And I remember thinking that was brilliant, but then Brazil went and ruined it. They won their fourth one in 1994. But this five-time tour winner club, this stat, it is, of course, it's one of the biggest recurring themes when we speak about the Tour de France, that this special number of five. And kind of weirdly, there's nobody has won four before Froome. You know, anybody who had won four ended up winning five. It's just one of those things. Greg LeMond ended up adding himself to the list of riders who'd won three. But yeah, anybody who had won four had won five, and Chris Froome is the only one now that hasn't. So, but yeah, it all started with Jacques Anquetil.
I think that's a really interesting thing, and I think it's about career length. I think Armstrong's the outlier, because I think Indurain could have won more than five, but at his point in history, there was that hierarchy, which we'll talk about in a minute, within the sport, that meant he was a really, really comfortable domestique for Pedro Delgado, and only really stepped up when Delgado started to falter. You know, and there was that one tour where it was unclear who was the leader, because Indurain was just so much stronger than Delgado, but he still waited loyally for his winner. Armstrong, I think, is the outlier, because he, once he started trying to win, you know, we might as well win, was completely devoted to the tour in a way that I don't think anybody really had been before. You know, Indurain was a more all-round rider. You know, Merckx, obviously, all-round riders. So Armstrong managed to get seven because he started his haul of being dedicated to the Tour earlier. But I think five might be the natural number for a normal career for a normal great cyclist, just because they don't have enough time, to win any more than that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, actually, because, like, Froome is he 34 now? I think Armstrong was 34 when he won his last one, but the other riders were relatively young. You know, the names we've mentioned so far, you know, they were all retired by the time they were the age of Froome is now. Eno
was famously gone, Eno, he announced his date of retirement years before it and stuck to it.
Yeah, he was gone by the age of 31. I think he might have just turned 32. Merckx had certainly stopped winning the Tour at that age, although he hung on for a couple more years. Indurain was similar. We kind of think of them as these elder statesmen, but they were relatively young when they stopped their time of greatness. And I don't know, maybe it's true that it's easier now for you to prolong a career longer, you know, health, medicine.
And easier to focus on the nutrition. Tour. You know, there isn't the all-round nature of riders like Eno, which is bound to take a toll on your body. So it wouldn't surprise me if we see more, sixes, maybe even another seven, because folk just ride the Tour.
Yeah, well, I actually think it takes a certain type of rider to focus on one race and keep winning it all the time. Like, obviously, Armstrong is the uber example of this. The other five-time winners did kind of spread their view to maybe widen their palmarès slightly. But Armstrong, didn't. After he won his first Tour, it was all for the Tour every year and only the Tour. We've spoken before about how he tried to win a classic every now and again, Amstel Gold or Liège, Bastogne Liège. But in general, they were really just a part of his training program for the Tour de France. And that he just had this laser focus. And it did kind of get me thinking about the two kinds of riders where one can do this year after year, just do the same thing over and over and have the ability to motivate themselves to such a level that they're actually capable of doing it year after year. I'd say, maybe you'd lump Chris Froome into that club. He does obviously win other races, although less so in recent years. But, in 2013, 14, 15, in his first couple of years when he was targeting the Tour, he would win the Dauphiné or the Tour de Romandie on the way. But again, it was all focused on the Tour de France. That's all Dave Brailsford really cares about by the looks of things. And just the ability to hone your mind and dedicate every little portion of your life, eating, walking, lying down, sleeping, everything towards these 3 weeks in July is unbelievably impressive. It might be monotonous or slightly boring from a fan's point of view that the same guy is doing this year after year and succeeding. But from a physiological and mental point of view, it's really impressive. Whereas there's another type of rider that doesn't seem to be able to do this. The archetype that comes to mind for me is Bradley Wiggins. He just seems to have a much more kind of scatological mindset, and he gets bored.
He's constantly trying to keep himself interested. That's why he moves from different track events to road cycling, to winning the Tour, to trying to win Paris-Roubaix, to rowing. I think he's got a very short attention span, but is able to have a laser-like focus, when he's within that span.
Yeah, that's what it seems. I suppose we could talk all day whether it's physiologically more difficult to win the Tour year after year than to do what Wiggins did. I'm not really sure what the answer is to that question, but mentally, they're just completely different. And it takes this ridiculous focus to be able to just do the same thing year after year. Rather than what Wiggins does, which, like you say, is kind of a scattergun approach to his goals, where he can't appreciate the achievement of winning something again. Why would you win it again when you've won it before? I've won it already. Let's move on and do something else. And I suppose that's borne out in what he's been doing post career, where he can't seem to settle. Maybe that's normal for a lot of cyclists. He did it. He tried the rowing thing. Now he's doing a podcast. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the club. Yep.
Everybody in their granny's doing a podcast. I'm thinking of training up the dog and attaching a microphone to her collar.
Yeah, sure, why not? But I do think there's this crazy mental focus that comes across in the books that are written about Armstrong. People have their opinions on Armstrong, and a lot of people have said they've thrown their Armstrong books in the fire and they'll never read them again. But there is something to them. Of course, he cheated, but on a kind of human level, as to what it took to do that year after year. Obviously, he took a lot of drugs, but the mental side of things can't be ignored. He was this like remorseless, just winning machine. Mm-hmm. And I do have kind of a theory on the Armstrong thing. I don't know whether you have noticed this. I actually, the first time somebody said it to me was I hosted this kind of event, the cycling event, where authors were talking about their books. There was three of them. There was Richard Moore, Tim Moore, and Ned Bolting. And they were, you know, talking about all things cycling. And it was quite shortly after, it was either just when the USADA reasoned decision came out, or perhaps it was after the Oprah Winfrey thing. Anyway, it was around that time. And so, you know, the hot topic was Armstrong and what people think. And I remember I don't know what the specific question was, but we ended up having a kind of a roundtable discussion about Armstrong. And the general feeling amongst all three of those guys was that ultimately, right now, Armstrong's name was gone from the record list. He'd been expunged, but that ultimately he'll creep back in. People will just accept that, you know, this was part of it. You know, of course, there are the stories about Christoph Basson and the there are guys that didn't dope, but ultimately he was amongst a lot of riders that did. You know, it's very unsatisfactory that nobody won those Tours de France, as Armstrong himself keeps on bleating on about. But ultimately, it'll creep back in, and people will start talking about Armstrong as the winner of those Tours. And I've actually noticed this already for a long time. You know, I think the outrage and the moral disgust that we all kind of had when this reasoned decision came out is fading. And I say we, I mean the media in general and fans. I think just collectively there's a kind of an acceptance creeping in. And I do remember in the aftermath of this decision and when Armstrong was stripped, that every time he was mentioned, whether be it on air by commentators or in print, in articles, online and in magazines and books, every time Armstrong was mentioned, there was, if not a literal asterisk, there would be, in brackets or some sort of explainer saying, you know, obviously we know he's been stripped, just a kind of a caveat. But those are disappearing. I've read examples recently in magazines and online of just, yeah, when Armstrong won the Tour in 2004 or whatever it is, without any, you know, disclaimer or caveat or whatever. And that's becoming more normal. I've done it myself. I know I've started giving up explaining that Armstrong didn't win those Tours in these shows, because everybody knows it and it's your decision whether to accept it or not. But I have noticed a general move away from having to explain it every time. And I think he is creeping back in. Maybe he'll never end up back on the official results list. He won't be hanging around looking at his seven yellow jerseys on the wall anymore. But kind of implicitly, I think he will be back in that five-time winner club, or seven-time winner as he is.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, those races happened. They were absolutely brilliant races to watch, most of them. You know, fantastic entertainment. I think if they were going to strip Armstrong, they had to leave that top step empty, because God only knows how far down, you know, the list of riders you'd have to go to get somebody clean. And when our children are doing Twitch in, 2075 or something, and look back and are talking about the early 21st century, they won't be able to ignore Armstrong. So he's absolutely bound to make his way back in. And I notice, actually, even when there's interviews with riders now, riders are mentioning him without, vitriol or hatred, and often, citing him as the reason that they started the sport. He's going to make his way back. He was the symptom of his time. He defined that era, and he just has to be acknowledged, I think.
Yeah, and, as we always say, his biggest crime, really, in the wider public was just being an asshole.
Yeah, just being a dick. That's what, I mean, that's why everybody wanted him hung, drawn, and quartered.
And people will forget that as well. You know, like young fans, 13, 14, 15-year-olds or whatever they might be, they don't really remember or know what a jerk he was. They won't know all these stories about Filippo Simeone and all the Andreus and every bad thing that Armstrong ever said to anyone, they're not going to know or care about that. So I think it is beginning already to fade, and every year it'll snowball, and I think he will kind of creep back into the collective consciousness of being a seven-time Tour winner. But going back to the 1964 Tour de France, something that really struck me and I'd never really noticed or kind of thought about before was that it was the first year that ended with a time trial.
I think every Grand Tour, every race should finish with a time trial.
Obviously, the most famous example was 1989, the Tour de France, where Greg LeMond beat Laurent Fignon.
Beautiful.
And they haven't done it since at the Tour de France, which, looking back on 1964, it kind of makes me even more surprised that they haven't tried this again. So time trials had been in the Tour for 1964. It was 30 years-ish that as a discipline, the individual time trial was part of the Tour. And it wasn't until 1964 that they decided to end the race with one. You know, there would be one, as there is now, on the penultimate stage or the second-to-last stage. Towards the end of the race, there always were time trials, but never on the last day like this. And they're just as in 1989, they got lucky with this race, the way it panned out, because, you know, I mentioned a couple of time gaps in the piece. Like, Anquetil ended up winning this Tour by 55 seconds. Well, Kowiak won a Tour by about I didn't say this in the piece. This is in my notes. So Anquetil won this Tour by 55 seconds. There was, a few years previously, in 1956, Radziwiłł Kowiak won that famous Tour, Alawal Kowiak. That's where the word comes from. He gained loads of time in a breakaway and defended it. But he won his Tour by 90 seconds. There had been a few won by 3-4 minutes, but they were very much the exception. In general, Tours de France were won by 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, sometimes over an hour. And that was the norm. There was no suspense coming into the last stage or last week. Even in some cases, you know, the Tour had been wrapped up, the strongest rider had emerged, and the yellow jersey was all but sealed with a few days to go. So to put an individual time trial at the end of a race was really, on paper, surely it was to give the rider who was in the yellow jersey a victory lap. You know, because that's what it would have been if the time gap had been 10 or 15 minutes. So for the organisers to do this and then get a situation with a week or 5 days to go where the gap between Anquetil and Poulidor was, I think it was as low as 9 seconds at one point, 14 seconds at another, and Anquetil ended, it was 14 seconds going into the final stage. And ultimately, okay, he won it by 55. But That was a stroke of luck, just as it had been in 1989, where it was a big risk. But unlike 1989, when for whatever reason they decided never to do this again or not to follow up, I think a lot of that had to do with the mindset of Jean-Marie Leblanc and what way he wanted to.
Also, a Frenchman had just lost in the most public podium in the world.
Well, that's true as well. Let's not do that again. Maybe they thought, yeah. But in 1964, it was the opposite. They decided they stumbled upon something brilliant, and they kept doing it. So it was the first time in 1964, but they kept doing it every year then. It was the final stage time trial until 1972. And shortly after that, then, they ended up on the Champs-Élysées, and that's what we've been doing ever since, including 1989, but as the exception in time trial form. But they did do it for 8 years thereafter, and it never really lit up the way it did the first time they tried it in 1964. But I just thought that was interesting. I hadn't really realized that it had never happened before that. And it also ended on the velodrome in Parc de Princes, which it's kind of maybe interesting bringing it back into the modern day again. They kind of did this in last year's Tour. It wasn't the final stage, but it was the final time trial on the penultimate stage, where they ended the time trial in the Stade Velodrome in Marseille. And I think it was quite visually impressive having them come into this stadium, and I don't think it was quite full, but it did give the impression of a big occasion, and it wasn't just, you know, a finish line in the middle of nowhere and then getting a flight to Paris the next day. It made a sense of occasion. And they used to do this all the time in the Tour, where it would finish on the Parc de Princes or another velodrome. And they used to do this in a lot of races, actually. It wasn't just the Tour de France, but it's kind of...
Well, amphitheatres for the Giro is the cliche, isn't it? I mean, just a time trial that finishes in an amphitheatre is a beautiful thing. And it's like that with a velodrome. I'm only half joking about wanting the final stage of every Grand Tour to be a time trial. And I'll tell you why. One is, of course, the memories of that, you know, that race in 89, which is, you know, it's engraved in my brain. But the second one is, I really hate final day processions. I mean, you know, if, as somebody who has to talk about cycling, I loathe the final day of Grand Tours, because, you know, you can only say, you know, the biggest guy in the race is on the smallest guy's bike, or they're, you know, they're stealing a policeman's gun, or they're, you know, they're drinking, what is it, Leffy now actually is Chris Froome's thing to drink in this final stage. So the time trial actually could be a race, because you could have a climber, you know, a minute and a half ahead going into the final stage with Tom Dumoulin, you know, maybe able to overhaul them by a few seconds. So it keeps some suspense for that final day. But I also think it would be a beautiful way to pay tribute to the riders who finish the race. You know, they get to be seen individually by people in the roadside. Yeah. And, you know, they get more recognition than they do just being anonymous in the bunch.
It's like the race organisers don't even try anymore with the final stage of the Tour de France. Like, I remember speaking before about the kind of the origins of why the final stage is such a procession. And I remember speaking about Stephen Roach being worried about an attack from Delgado on the final day in 1987. So back then, it was still a worry that something would happen on the final day. And then it just so happened that the Tours thereafter were already, the leader was minutes ahead coming into the final day. So kind of the countenancing an attack of any sort on the final day would have been folly anyway. So there was just no point, and it just became something that just wasn't even tried. And then just because of the race circumstances of so many years in a row, riders just didn't bother attacking on the final day, and it became this procession. And then it was kind of a real nail in the coffin for the final day was Armstrong drinking champagne on the final stage during his winning years. And now it's just, it's like the race organizers don't even try. They've now put it later in the evening, so it has this kind of party feel to it even more. So it's like dark by the time the stage is over.
And they don't even show in the Arc de Triomphe, you know.
Yeah. It's become this big party. Like, it's not a race. It's not a sporting spectacle anymore. They don't even try to have the penultimate stage finish anywhere near Paris anymore, which they did really. They used to kind of route it almost towards Paris to have the final stage, the penultimate stage finish near enough so that the transfer wasn't that bad. But now they don't even try that. The penultimate stage can finish in the Pyrenees. Mm-hmm. And they have to make their way all the way up to Paris. And I know a lot of journalists don't even bother going to the final stage anymore because A, nothing happens, and B, it's like it's so far away from where the previous stage finished, they might as well just go home. So it is really like the tour organizers have embraced this idea of a party on the final day, and nothing sporting is going to happen. Of course, there's the bunch sprint for, you know, the kind of the sprinters' world championships, as we call it. But apart, you know, nothing's going to happen on the GC, and they've accepted that. Now, like you say, if there was a time trial, it would be obviously completely different. And I'm kind of on board with that idea to snap the tour out of this idea that it's only 20 days worth of racing instead of 21, as it should be.
No, I was only half joking. We'll move on shortly. I've got to say, this is possibly the tour with one of my top three cycling photos of all time, which is Raymond Poulidor and Jacques Anquetil shoulder to shoulder in the Puy de Dôme.
Yeah, so I guess like the detail, this 1964 tour was really the best example of a ding-dong battle between Anquetil and Poulidor. Previous tours had seen the two riders go head-to-head, but it was always just kind of Anquetil toying with him, whereas this tour kind of ended up like Anquetil toying with Poulidor again, but not really, didn't have things all his own way. And it did seem for a while that Poulidor had finally had the beating of Anquetil. And, you know, reading more of that book written by Richard Yates, like in the contemporary race reports of the time, wrapping up the report of Anquetil's victory, a lot of them seemed to kind of say Poulidor has him now, that it was so close this year that obviously Anquetil is there for the taking and Poulidor should win the Tour de France next year. But of course, next year was 1965 and Felice Gimondi came along, who probably nobody had heard of in 1964. It was his first year racing in 65 and he won the Tour. And then it wasn't long before Merckx came along to make Poulidor's life a misery as well. So it was the closest really that Poulidor would ever come to winning the Tour. And but this famous photo, as you mentioned, is Anquetil and Poulidor literally barging shoulders with each other on the way up the Puy de Dôme, which was three stages to go before the end of the race. And Poulidor kind of, you know, stuck the boot in a little bit, gained some time back, but not enough for him to win the Tour de France, and Anquetil managed to claw it back. And it really is one of the most famous photos. I'll put it in the Twitch notes. I can't really imagine many people haven't seen it before, but if you haven't, it's fantastic. It always kind of strikes me that Poulidor doesn't really look like Poulidor in it. I don't know what it is about it. It looks like he's, whatever way the shadows fall, it looks like he's got a little mustache. He just looks a little bit different. It always strikes me that he looks quite strange in it. But it just sums up an era, and sums up the closest that rivalry would ever get to being a rivalry in Anquetil's mind. It never really was a rivalry. It was just Anquetil beating Poulidor all the time. But that quote at the end of the piece that I mentioned, I finish up with that quote from Richard Yates. It kind of sounds a little bit fanciful, you know, that the pair of them were arm in arm on the podium and Anquetil giving Poulidor a little grin. I do wonder how true that is, whether it's just one of these florid poetic license things that writers are, you know, tend to slip into their writing from time to time, because it gives the impression there that, you know, after all was said and done, these guys were buddies. I don't really think that was the case, and the story as it unfolded from then after that tour, weirdly or not for the time, but weirdly these days, the French national championships happened after the tour that year in August. And maybe just to give a bit of color as to how this rivalry really was, and it wasn't arms in arms on a podium and all smiles, Anquetil decided, as he tended to do from time to time before a race, that he wasn't interested in winning, that he had a bit of a dicky tummy and didn't really fancy going for the win in the French National Championship. So he decided that he'd be riding for his trade teammate Jean Stablinski, who was going for three in a row, and that's what he did. Stablinski ended up winning, and Anquetil spent his whole race just riding around neutralizing Raymond Poulidor.
Yeah.
just despite him, and that's the way it was. So that the impression given there in that brief snapshot was that these guys were friends, but that's not really true. And
I don't think I've ever seen an indication that Jacques Anquetil would warm to anybody, you know, other than a woman. You know, he was a very spiky character. It's funny, the first holiday Ilse and I had ever had abroad, and I think I might have told you this before, we went first to the Cambridge Folk Festival because we were hippies, and then we went to walk the Grand Rondonnée 5, which goes through the Auvergne in France, and it goes, you know, past Puy de Dôme. And one of the saddest days of my life was when I saw the sign at the bottom then that said, you know, cyclists not allowed. Because if I'd had a bike with me, riding that, you know, based purely on that iconic photo, would have been something I would have loved to have done. But presumably they were worried about people dropping dead and all sorts of stuff, because it's a real bugger of a climb.
Yeah, I think that's still the case. I still think you're not allowed to officially cycle up that. It hasn't been in the Tour since 1988, and it doesn't look like it could be in the Tour again the way it is at the moment. So yeah, I think that's still the case. I think that's still true.
I've had some really interesting discussions this week, largely after an article on cyclingnews.com by Philippa York, about Chris Froome's, you know, attempt to win a fifth, about the nature of greatness in cycling. Mm. Anquetil, I think, would be on anybody's list as one of the greats. Eno, absolutely, certainly. Merckx, you know, don't make me laugh. He's the very definition of a great. Indurain, maybe not so much, because that's when we're into that period of specialisation. It's more than about winning the Tour, much though the Tour has come to dominate the sport in recent years. It's also about personality. You know, one of my chums on Twitter, Derek, was saying that it was really about charisma as much as anything else. So, I mean, maybe we'll discuss greatness, but this next piece, I think, it has elements of that, because it's about, you know, the nature of influence. You know, Bernardino famously being the, you know, the patron in the sport. It was about how the sport had a clear hierarchy. So, you know, let's hear a piece about that.
Sean Kelly had been winning races for years. He was a feared sprinter who had won 5 Tour de France stages, 2 green jerseys, and 7 stages of the Vuelta. He'd finished top 10 in Milan-San Remo, the Tour of Flanders, and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but he couldn't crack the classics for years. It wasn't until he was 27 that he finally bent one to his will by winning the 1983 Tour of Lombardy. I remember him saying during commentary once on Eurosport that one of the reasons it can be so hard for a strong rider like him to win races, it seems that he should be winning, is that the established stars like to spread the wealth among themselves. That there is an inherent hierarchy in the peloton, a hierarchy which isn't easy to infiltrate. Places at the top table are limited, and the guys sitting there don't take too kindly to young upstarts trying to stick their arses on the edge of one of those seats, trying to scooch their way in. Kelly said that the big names would rather one of the other big names win, instead of somebody new trying to make a name for themselves. As hard as it was to win the biggest races in cycling, this peculiar feudal structure made it even harder. Peter Cossens mentions this idea dating back even 40 years before Kelly's time in his new book, Full Gas, How to Win a Bike Race, Tactics from Inside the Peloton. The two men's influence wasn't limited to their own teams either. Rival riders would ask Fausto Coppi and Gino Bartali and other leading Campione for permission before joining a breakaway or going for a stage win. Threats to this hierarchy were stamped down, emerging riders suddenly finding they had a good part of the Italian Gruppo riding against them. During the 1946 Giro, for instance, in the midst of one of their most hotly contested battles, Coppi and Bartali agreed a deal to suppress the emergence of Vito Ortelli after the youngster led the race for several days. These structures also applied to the gregari, who were obliged to ride for their leader in every circumstance. Dubbed cyclisme à l'italienne by the French, this approach to racing was brutally disciplined but supremely effective. The top teams and their campionissimi ruled the roost, relegating the rest of the riders to a supporting role as gregari, racing in what was effectively a state of serfdom rather than as plucky domestiques, never granted even the occasional opportunity to ride for themselves. By colluding with each other, the established stars ensured a closed shop. This closed shop didn't just keep a close rein on race wins, it of course extended to the more important aspect of cycling, the money. Salaries were much more modest, even in Kelly's day, than they are now. In Coppi's, a cyclist was akin to a coal miner. The real money was to be made in appearance fees. Nowadays, we've seen the likes of Chris Froome and Lance Armstrong pocketing millions of euro in appearance fees when they turn up at the biggest races, as if their salaries and endorsement deals weren't making them rich enough already. The appearance fees only further accentuate the financial disparity between the haves and the have-nots. It's accepted as common practice now, even if the amounts and the details are not generally publicly disclosed, if the organisers can help it. But it wasn't always the case. Back in February of 1958, the following appeared in Sporting Cyclist magazine regarding some race organisers willing to pay start fees and many others wanting to ban the practice. These organisers, certain that the crowd will show up if the big names are riding, are willing to pay big money and sometimes unreasonable money to secure their services. Whose business is that anyway, the riders say, and why should the classic race organisers be against this? Our racing life is only a short one, and why shouldn't we get the best out of it? Few of us will get decent jobs and security when we quit. In his office at Bilbao, the Tour of Spain organiser was working hard to make sure his race was better every year. What better could he do than hire the best men in the business, even if they fooled him each time by treating his Vuelta as a means of riding themselves in as preparation for the more important Giro d'Italia and Tour de France. Señor Bergeresh had powerful firms to sponsor his race, but they were only willing to help him if he had a good number of the top men riding, or at least starting. How could I refuse paying what they asked, he questioned last year. The aces will stay at home if I don't see their way, and my race will only be a little one with nobody but our nationals to ride in it. You may think the whole situation fair enough, that a rider is entitled to pocket whatever an organiser is willing to pay, but road cycling is already threatened with all sorts of dangers and may well disappear altogether if something is not done rapidly.
So we've got two pieces that delve back into the 50s and 60s, which I think we've neglected to a certain extent over the years with Twitch. You know, I think it's maybe just it falls into that thing slightly beyond what we can comfortably remember, but not long enough ago to seem like, you know, proper history. Well, although it's 50 or 60 years now.
Well, I do think there's something to that. It got me thinking, like, you know, I decided that, you know, Froome is about to try to do something that hadn't been done. And okay, when was the first time it was done? It was 1964. So then I thought, okay, yeah, I'll do something on Anquetil. And it did kind of get me thinking that that entire era of cyclists, the greats at that time, Anquetil, Louis-Saint-Bobet, Charlie Gall, I don't actually know a whole lot about them, and I don't know, it got me thinking why that is. And like you said, I do think that era, which a lot of people regard as the golden era of cycling, it kind of just slips between my mental cracks, because it's not as, it's, you know, World War II is kind of this massive punctuation mark in the timeline of history and cycling history. So to go back that far, okay, you're talking about World War II and before and afterwards. Yeah, like you said, I think there is something in that, that, you know, Eddie Merckx is kind of easier to talk about and to relate to because he's still alive, first of all. And a lot of his contemporaries are still alive, although some of them sadly are not. But, you know, a lot of them are. But as soon as you move back to the 1950s and the early 60s, they're kind of gone. And it's...
I think that's why Richard Muir's book Etapes is so important, because it's gathering voices before they're lost forever.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said for that, because, you know, we have lost a few in the last couple of years, and the stories that die with them. And I don't know if that's a good reason or if that's the right reason, but I have ignored this period of cycling history. So maybe definitely something to rectify in the weeks and months to come, because my knowledge of the 50s and early 60s could be a lot better. And I've no excuse. Like, there's loads of books, like certainly about Anquetil, there's loads of books. There's loads of books in general about these guys and that era. So definitely, yeah, dig into the archives a bit better on the 50s and early 60s.
Anyway, many aspects of cycling then, you know, with the pill bottle in the back pocket, all that kind of stuff, we've consigned to history. You know, let's mostly agree on that one. Do you think this suppression of incomers, you know, the wanting to smother new talent and spread the race wins out amongst the established stars until somebody is just so powerful they break through, you know, that glass ceiling of the second road, do you think it still exists?
I kind of do, yeah, and riders don't tend to talk about this explicitly, understandably, because if you're at this top table and you're part of this group, you don't really want to be acknowledging it, that, you know, oh, I've made it, you know, let's if you talk about it, it might all crumble down and disappear. So if you get there, you're probably unlikely to acknowledge it. But I do think it still happens, you know, kind of in a strange related way. You know, you get these guys. Everybody, every era always complains about the young guys who have no respect for anyone anymore. You know, like Cavendish said it.
Yeah.
I remember last year, I remember him in an interview. He said that he thinks young riders don't have any respect anymore. Mark Cavendish, you know, when he was 22 or 23, had no respect for anyone.
I'm a cocky wee bastard.
But that's the way it always is. You know, the old guys get old and they start whinging about the young guys, and the young guys come along and think they're the absolute bee's knees and don't care about, you know, the status of the older guys. That's the way it is in every era. It was going back to when Eddie Merckx came along and started upsetting Rick Van Looy, and, you know, everything to do with that. And like that closed shop idea, you know, it was obviously, has been acknowledged by Sean Kelly that it was a thing in his day. And I do think there's something to it. Like, I, you know, taking Cavendish as an example, I think he would much rather be beaten in a sprint by the likes of Marcel Kittel or André Greipel than by these young cocky upstarts like Dylan Groenewegen or Caleb Ewan.
Yeah.
That, you know, nobody wants, these older guys don't want this hierarchy rocked. Now, I do think we're at certainly with the sprinters, we're at a point at which I don't think these older guys are going to have much say anymore. I think the younger guys are really starting to shine, and there's nothing they can do about it. And of course, that will always happen.
I think we're in a golden age for sprinting right now. I mean, it's a phrase I don't use very often, but I've been watching this sport since the early 70s. I can't remember a period where there's been so many good sprinters coming through. While established guys are still really on top of their game. It's brilliant.
Yeah, the list for the Tour de France is frightening.
No Caleb Ewan, though.
Well, yeah, I suggested on Twitter, and I got shouted down a lot, that this was because the move had been made from 9-man teams to 8-man teams. And, you know, a lot of people said, well, you know, it's not. It's because he's moving to Lotto Bellisol next year. And that's does seem to be true, and I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. But the 9-man, 8-man team thing is interesting. I remember writing a piece a few years ago about teams that had tried to split themselves in two, in the Tour. You know, Telecom were a famous example of a team which successfully did it. You know, they won the Tour twice in a row with Reese and Ulrich, both of which both times they also won the green jersey with Zabel.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to do that. And there are very few teams in cycling history who have managed to win two jerseys with two different riders. I remember this came up last year because Sunweb did it with Barguil and Michael Matthews, and it is very rare. And you know, if you're cutting teams from 9 to 8 riders, the potential for a team to decide to do it is getting less and less. I don't think there are going to be many teams in this year's Tour that have a sprinter and a GC rider. I know UAE are doing it with Dan Martin and Alexander Kristoff. I know Katusha are doing it with Marcel Kittel and Ilner Zakarin, but it's not
a big surprise, actually. No Nathan Haas for Katusha, and he's been riding like a demon all year.
Yeah, that's a strange one, isn't it? Katusha's a bit of a strange team these days, but these are the kinds of riders and that will just miss out because they just don't have enough scope to bring everyone anymore. Yeah. And this will happen more and more. But actually, just before we go on about this, the idea of this closed shop, the book that I got that quote from Peter Costens, his new one, Full Gas, it's absolutely brilliant. I'm kind of halfway through it. Definitely have a book show in the works. Peter Costens is prolific on the book show because
call it the Costens Cast.
Well, he keeps writing these books that just don't, nobody's written them before. You know, they're not rehashes of or revisits of different topics. Like, as far as I'm aware, nobody's written a book about tactics in the bunch.
I'm really looking forward to reading Full Gas. It hits all the spots for me.
Yeah, like even just the part, like every paragraph is just kind of, you know, makes you think, huh, never really thought of that before. And even just the paragraph before the one I've picked out there about Coppi and Bartali and the idea of the haves and the have-nots and that, he mentions the tactic of sending your domestiques up the road so that they're available to you later on in the race. Now, this is something that we just take for granted these days, that, you know, of course riders will try to do that, so that, you know, you send the big time trialist workhorse in the breakaway. Vasyl Kiriyenka is a prime example. You send him up the road in a breakaway so that he's available to Chris Froome in the valleys between the climbs when Froome makes his move. And this is just an established tactic that works. And if you have guys up the road that can help you, then you're at an advantage. But, you know, back then it was like, it was almost like domestiques were, the idea of them were still relatively new. Henri de Grange had made great efforts to ensure that teams couldn't work this way, and that it should be the strongest rider that wins the race, and it shouldn't be the strength of his team or, you know, any kind of, the idea of drafting and even mechanical assistance via using derailleurs was abhorrent to him, and he just didn't like it, and he really kind of tried to stultify any progress with this. So the idea of a domestique was, you know, becoming more and more normal, but how to use them hadn't been established. And it was Fausto Coppi, as Cotton says in his book, was the first person to realize that there's no point in me having domestiques who are almost by definition weaker than me behind me in the race. What use are they to me there? So send them up the road, you know, have them literally wait for me on the side of the road if needs be, and I'll use them to better effect if they're up the road waiting.
Bundle him to save his energy.
Yeah, so there's just loads of little nuggets in there that in the book that kind of explain the way the racing is now and who did it first and why. And it's brilliant. I'm halfway through. I'm not even halfway through. I'm only a quarter of the way through, really. And it's an education, really. So very much looking forward to talking to Peter about that.
I tell you, let's talk about one of the things in here. Starting money, you know, we had all the talk about the, you know, the 2 million or whatever to start the Giro for Chris Froome this year. It has been part of this sport forever, and it's something that people don't really talk about. Good thing, bad thing? What do you think?
Well, I found this article in... I got this from that website again, you know, the Velo... What is it called?
Veteran Cycle Club Library.
Veteran Cycle Club Library, yeah, that's it. So they do have these issues of sporting cyclists, which used to be called Coureur magazine. And I got this from that. And you know, it goes through the reasons why paying start money can destroy the sport. And I find it funny that you know, even back in the 1950s, they were worried about the future of the sport, and we still talk about it. You know, the team model is unsustainable, and if we keep on this path, the sport won't exist. But it will. You know, it has existed with team sponsors since 1969, and it's shite. Like, it doesn't work well, but it
but it stumbles along.
It stumbles along, yeah, and these things come up every now and again, and in the 1950s, this writer, whose name was actually René Delatour, brilliantly, an American, actually, strangely, he had emigrated from
France. Sounds like a character in Hello.
Yeah, just what's the most stereotypical French name we can come up with here, and plunk it in. But he was a writer for Sporting Cyclists, and he wrote this piece about kind of pondering the disappearance of the sport, because start fees were kind of destroying the house of cards, the financial house of cards that the sport was built on then, and still is now, I guess. But they actually did manage to ban this practice of paying start riders money, paying riders start money. So the argument at that time was that some races were doing it and some races were not. And the big riders were kind of avoiding the races that wouldn't pay them any money. And there was this disparity happening between races, and there was this kind of two-tier calendar almost of races that were doing it and races that weren't, and everybody was worried that the smaller races would disappear because the big names weren't there and the media wouldn't cover them, and it was all just very concerning for all involved. So there was an organization of race organizations, like a collective, which ganged up on the race organizers who were paying start money and said, we want you to stop doing this. And they succeeded. Everybody agreed, okay, this is a bad thing, let's ban this. And obviously that it didn't work. Yeah. it obviously didn't. I mean, it's not people are still getting paid start money today, so it obviously went wrong somewhere along the way, but I imagine it never worked. Like, how do you police that? You can't. Okay, races can stop announcing that they're paying a guy to take part, but they can still give him money. You know,
yeah, you can no more police it than you can, you know, riders making arrangements on the road.
Yeah, you know, we heard this year that Froome was getting start money for the Giro. We've heard in the past that Armstrong got start money for the Tour Down Under.
Well, Armstrong actually is the one who I think brought this to the fore again, and he seems to be a figure looming large in this particular show. But I only really became aware of start money payments around the Armstrong time again, even though they were probably there before that, certainly.
Well, I remember him getting paid for riding the Tour of Ireland when it was had a little bit of a revival, the Tour of Ireland in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. And I think it continued till 2010, and it hasn't been raced since. But Armstrong rode it when he made his comeback, and apparently this was kind of tit for tat for him organizing his big kind of summit. When he came back in 2009 in Dublin, and there was, you know, Pat McQuaid was the UCI president, and Pat McQuaid's brother was the organizer of the Tour of Ireland. It was all very, all very nepotistic. But anyway, there was lots of reasons why Armstrong was at the Tour of Ireland, but one of them was apparently that he got paid to do it. And I remember going out and watching the stage that finished in Cork. It finished on, I don't know whether you remember, people might remember, there's a famous hill in Cork City called St. Patrick's Hill, where the Nissan Classic used to go every year.
Is that the Copley one?
Yeah, I wouldn't quite call them cobbles. It's kind of rutted. They're not cobbles, but it's not smooth. It's pretty horrible, but it's really steep. It's very short, but it's really steep. I don't know what the percentage is, but I'd say it's upwards of 20% for 200 or 300 meters. And this was the kind of the showpiece few minutes of the entire race, was the bunch going up this climb. I think they went up it three times or four times, maybe, actually, and this in this loop of the city after they had done 100 or 150 kilometers around Cork. And when the race got to the city, Armstrong climbed off his bike and just got into the team car and said, you know, I'm not doing that. The weather was really bad, and he decided, I'm not doing that. So it was a real two fingers to the fans that had come out to see him, you know. And but I suppose that's the risk you run when you pay these guys. They don't necessarily have to try very hard after you pay them to get them to your race. But I just found it funny that they agreed, race organizers agreed to stop doing it, but it's impossible to police that. Absolutely impossible. And so, my point was going to be that we know that Armstrong and Froome got paid this money, or we know up to a point that they got paid. But like, surely this happens constantly where we don't find out, and it's just something that goes on in the background, and we're never privy to it. And you know, why should we be? And that's the way the sport works, you know. And there was this, the writer was kind of pondering in that piece, you know, why shouldn't the writers capitalize and get start money? And I'd kind of be in agreement with that. You know, there's only a short career. Yeah, exactly. There's a short window where these guys can make money. And, you know, we've done plenty of stories in the past of guys where they reach the end of their career and it all really goes badly wrong. A lot of them end up skint. Some of them end up committing suicide over it and just can't handle the life after being a cyclist. And, you know, if making money, making enough money or trying to make enough money to last them into actual retirement age, you know, pensionable age in life is something that these guys have to do during their careers, then so be it. And, you know, it is a short career. It's only 10 years maybe that these guys have to make money. Now, the sums of money we're talking about, they're much bigger now than they were back in the 1950s, as I mentioned in the piece.
You were a blue-collar worker if you were a cyclist in the 50s.
Yeah, so if somebody was going to give you £100 to start in a race back then, you know, of course you're going to take it. Of course this little sub culture of financial wheeling and dealing would emerge, and you know, it hasn't gone anywhere. I'm sure it still goes on way more than we're made privy to.
Actually, looking at the names here, Coppi, Bertali, all of these things, I think anybody would agree they're in the kind of pantheon of the greats in cycling. Mm. And before you started this piece, I was talking about Philippa York's piece in cyclingnews.com.
Yeah.
And it's a really kind of intangible thing, greatness. Because, you know, we were talking before we started recording, have a drink, about how even if Froome won 6 or 7 tours, I wouldn't regard him as one of the greats of cycling. I'd regard him as, you know, the best Grand Tour rider of all time, maybe. But that's a statistical thing. Greatness is a whole combination of things, one of which I think is very difficult today, and that's to win a lot of races over a large number of disciplines, like Eno, like Merckx, you know. Even Greg LeMond, who I think is a level below those two, even though he's my favourite rider, we saw him trying to win other races, you know. Famously, he turned up at Paris-Roubaix and supported Gilbert Duclos-Lassalle and all that kind of stuff. So I think you need a broader palmarès. But there's also the indefinable, which is personality. You know, you have to have some kind of thing, a hook, if you like, for the public, for us as observers of the sport, to hang that greatness on. And it's really difficult. You know, I'm not sure what makes a rider great, but it's a lot more than just a list of stats.
Well, Anquetil is an interesting example because he's undeniably got one of the greatest palmarès, but he really struggled to captivate the French audience.
Well, they prefer poo-poo.
And that's it. That little nugget followed him around his entire career, where the French public just preferred Raymond Poulidor. And, you know, there were many reasons for that, racing reasons and personality reasons. And Anquetil went to great effort to try to overturn that. You know, we've spoken before about his endeavour of racing the Dauphiné and then going off and riding Bordeaux-Paris the next day and winning both. And this was an attempt to say, look, you know, what do I have to do here to be considered the best French rider, or be considered your favorite French rider? What can I do? What I can't do anymore. And he went through periods of exasperation where he couldn't get there. And so it had nothing really to do with his palmarès as such, but just the way in which he was gathering it. And of course the lovable nature of, you know, the lovable loser, although, you know, Poulidor won plenty of races, but he had this caricature of himself as a lovable loser that just couldn't beat anybody in the Tour de France. And that's just the way Anquetil's career went. The Chris Froome example is interesting as well, because it's not going to be solely based on his palmarès either. But he, as far as I can see, really, unlike Anquetil, Froome's done really nothing to try to ingratiate himself with, you know, his fans, the British public. Part of it, I guess, is because he's rather nationality-less you know, he has this weird upbringing where people don't really know what to make of him. He's not English. You know, he's called British because he has a British passport, but he's not really from a British country. He's not Scottish. He's not English. He's not Welsh. But he's called British because this is the nationality that's been bestowed upon him. He's been brought up in Africa. You know, the British public at large don't really know how to embrace that, I think. But he doesn't help himself either. You know, even after winning the tour, he doesn't go on the breakfast shows. He doesn't go on the news channels the way that Wiggins did. Wiggins, you know, undeniably English to start off with. But Froome didn't even try. He doesn't ride the National Road Race Championships. As we speak, this is about to happen this weekend. Again, Froome's not going to be there. Unlike, say, Cavendish, who is always there, always mucks in, even when it's on a route that he cannot win. He goes and he, you know, he makes the effort to try and win his home race. Like, I remember there was a great race on the route of the Lincoln GP a few years ago, and he almost won.
Oh, that was the British Championships. That was a fantastic ride by Cav.
Yeah, I think he finished second. He was behind Pete Kenyak, who, like, a completely different rider, ended up winning on the final climb. But, you know, Cavendish was there really trying to win those stripes, and Froome doesn't try to do that. And, you know, it's completely small beans compared to the Tour de France. Of course it is. But it's not to do with the Palmares. It's to do with the perception of you in public. And he hasn't done it. He hasn't tried. He probably doesn't care. And, you know, that's fine. But like you say, it does affect his standing, the perception of him in the pantheon of greats. And yeah, it's a weird one. It's intangible. I mean, how can you look at somebody who's won or maybe about to win five tours, about to win four grand tours in a row, you know, doing the Giro Tour double if he manages it, something that we thought was impossible this day and age. And of course, there's all the caveats with the Salbutamol and whatever you think about that. But you know, the achievements are up there with the greats. But he doesn't do it for me.
And it's funny, and I don't think it's just about personality. I've been thinking hard about this for a few days, and I think you just know. I mean, if you look at Peter Sagan, for example, I think we're watching somebody who will be remembered as one of the great classics riders. And we're watching some people who are, you know, Cavendish. We're watching possibly the greatest sprinter of all time, and he's still riding. You know, you just know that they're going to be up there even before their Palmares are gathered. Kelly, we knew, was going to be great. And we had the same discussions about Kelly, or, you know, certainly back then, people were having the same discussion about Kelly as we had about Peter Sagan until, you know, he won Flanders, which was, he's getting on a bit and he's not really won big yet. And it wasn't until Kelly won Lombardy that, you know, his Palmares started to build properly, moving away from kind of pure sprinter roadman kind of stuff. But he already knew he was a great. I really can't put it into words. It needs a better writer, or, you know, somebody better able to express themselves than me to define what a great is.
Well, he doesn't ride one day races. He certainly doesn't win them. He's never won one, and he doesn't even ride them really.
No, I mean, the only one I was thinking hard about Froome with that, and the only one I can think is he actually did help Cav win his world championship, you know, for the Project Britain thing. But you know, he doesn't, and maybe it's not his fault. Maybe it's just the nature of the sport these days, and we're not going to see the great all-rounders. The closest one is Nibali.
Oh yeah, I mean, he's fantastic. I mean, his win in Milan-San Remo and the fact that he has this broad Palmares is absolutely wonderful. I'd like to see him do well in the Tour de France this year. But speaking of Grand Tours, actually, maybe just before we finish up, I know the.
It's only 40 degrees here. Don't hurry. I should point out to our beloved subscribers that my computer and recording station is behind a massive glass window, and it's extremely hot here. I'm slowly starting to melt. So if I expire before the end of the show, you'll just have to finish up, Kelly.
Right. Okay. Well, just briefly then, the interesting thing that another interesting thing that I read in that article was that. The reference to the Vuelta, the Giro, and the Tour as a group of three races. Now, it was kind of an implicit reference. They didn't call them Grand Tours. I think God, it was a while ago now since we've done a show, but I think it was the last show we did. It might have been the one before. Was we were speaking about the origin of the term Grand Tour, and that I think it's a relatively recent thing. It was born out of the 1990s, as recently as that. But I did find it interesting that, you know, they were talking that again. The writer René de la Tour was talking about the organizer of the Tour of Spain, and bemoaning the fact that people were treating his race as a warm up for the bigger races, the Giro and the Tour de France, as if the three of them should be seen on an even footing. And it's you know, that's definitely the earliest I've seen that, and that was 1958. Remember back then, like the Vuelta, you know, it was sometimes only 2 weeks. It wasn't as prestigious as the Giro. The Tour hadn't been around that long. It'd only been around for 20 odd years at that point. And but you know, 1958 is very early for those races to be considered as a cluster. And and the Vuelta still had the problem then that it has now, where it's considered a warm up race for plenty. Back then it was for the Giro or the Tour. Nowadays it's for the Worlds. So you know, some things never change.
Yeah, of course we're recording this a week before the Tour de France. You'll be joining us in, you know,
some form or another
over the 3 weeks. You know, family comes first, of course, but it wouldn't be a Tour de France without Killian's Nerdy Nuggets or us doing a full show. It's something where, you know, it's the best time of the year for me. It's when cycling fans all get focused. It's by no means my favourite race, but it's also a rich, rich vein of history. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about that, Killian. Where can people find you on the internet?
I'm still at Irish Peloton on Twitter, although maybe not as active as I sometimes am. And my mail is mail@irishpeloton.com.
Now, the Great Unwashed are actually going to get a sample of this show. I'm going to put it out as a free show, as a kind of advert before the tour coverage. So if if you've listened to this, you've enjoyed what you've heard, if you've listened to our free weekly show and the upcoming tour preview and you like that, then please consider subscribing at velocast.cc.